quickly skinning their tires on the granite curbs. The lanes had to be closed while workmen laboriously chipped away the edges of the curbstones, and the workmen would be chipping, and the lanes would be closed for 3 years. The lack of new interborough bridges and tunnels wasn't due to a lack of ideas. New York was littered with evidence to prove that there had been plenty of those. But the evidence also proved how difficult it was, in New York, for ideas to become reality. In a weed-filled vacant lot in Riverdale, just north of the Harlem River, stood a marble column 100 feet high with a strangely unfinished look about its top. There was supposed to be a statue up there, a statue of Hendrik Hudson, for the vacant lot had been purchased by the city as the northern bridgehead of a Hendrik Hudson Bridge that was supposed to ease the congestion on the Broadway drawbridge, and a statue of the great navigator was supposed to look down on the span that bore his name. But although the lot had been purchased and the column erected in 1909, in 1932 work had still not started on the statue or the bridge. On the shoreline in Brooklyn's Bay Ridge section, at the edge of the Narrows, stood two rude wooden palisades, rotting from a decade's exposure to sea spray. The palisades had been erected to keep children from falling into two huge holes, each 96 feet deep. Directly across the Narrows, dug into the Staten Island shoreline, were two similar holes. The four holes had been the start of the shaft heads for a great Narrows tube designed to link Brooklyn with Staten Island. Work on the tube had begun in 1921. The city had spent more than $7 million on it. But digging had been stopped in 1923 and never resumed, and in 1932 the project was dead, the four empty holes the only evidence of the money spent on it. And marching across low-lying Ward's Island in the East River were 17 massive masonry piers, each of them 40 feet thick, 80 feet long, more than 100 feet high. These piers had been erected to support the central span of the Triborough Bridge, first proposed in 1910, that would link together at last Manhattan, the Bronx, and Queens. But in 1932, the piers had been standing for more than 2 years, and there was still no bridge for them to support, and hope that there ever would be was rapidly fading. As for New York's parks, they were scabs on the face of the city. Parks were the city's legacy from reformers who had fought against long odds for their creation. Under Tammany, they had become fiefs administered for private gain. The Brooklyn Park Department paid for hundreds of thousands of cubic yards of landfill that it never received. It constructed a large restaurant and, for a yearly rental of $10, turned over its keys to a restaurateur who was allowed to keep all profits. When a Brooklyn brick manufacturer needed 10 acres for a new storage area, the department allowed him to rent 10 acres of Diker Beach Park for a rental of $2.50 per year. And during his term as Brooklyn Park Commissioner, James J. Brown banked $1,071,713. Some of the city's choicest public beachfront, in Wolf's Pond Park on Staten Island and at Orchard Beach in the Bronx, for example, was rented to political insiders, who, for a fee of $15, were allowed to erect private bungalows on it and to form civic associations that promulgated regulations closing the beaches to the public. Because parks were a handy place to conceal drunks and loafers, Tammany staffed the park departments with the dregs of its barrel of ward healers. Because skilled laborers' higher salaries would reduce the amount of patronage that could be distributed, Tammany balked at hiring skilled workers even for those jobs that required skills. So that most of the park department budgets could be devoted to salaries, Tammany scrimped on materials and equipment, spending exactly $225,000 of the total park budget of $8,576,319 on such luxuries in 1932, and in that year, 90% of park department vehicles were still horse-drawn. By 1932, the paths, walks, and roadways in New York's parks were miles of broken pavement. The lawns, seldom mowed, sometimes looked more like meadows. So many trees were dying that some of the loveliest tree-bordered walks were bordered mostly by stumps, the result of allowing unskilled and unsupervised workers to prune trees by simply climbing up to the top of their ladders and sawing trees off at that height, since they were reluctant to risk their own limbs by climbing out on trees. According to a Park Association survey, there was not a single structure of any type in any park in the city that was not in need of immediate repair. What the city called a playground was an open space, equipped with slides and a swing or two, sometimes equipped with nothing at all, around which chicken wire had been strung. Most playgrounds were not surfaced. Rain turned them into mud holes. Others were surfaced with cinders spread loosely over the dirt, and mothers hated to let their children play in them because they knew the children would come home covered with cuts. If one of the hundreds of statues in the parks was undamaged in 1932, the Park Association couldn't find it. The faces of the statues were masses of bird droppings. Obscenities had been written on, and never erased from, their chests. Their identifying plaques had been torn off. Swords were missing from sheaths, laurel wreaths from brows. Poets plucked at broken harps. Saints stood on cracked pedestals. An Indian hunter had lost his bow. The tiger in Central Park was slipping off his rock. The bayonets had been stolen off the rifles of the soldiers in the 7th Regiment Memorial on 5th Avenue. The ironwork that could be seen in the parks, the fences, benches, and playground equipment, was pitted and caked with rust. The condition of the ironwork that couldn't be seen was indicated by the rarity of the comfort stations whose plumbing worked. Since park concessions were handed out to anyone who could raise the necessary payoff, pushcarts and ramshackle booths crowded park paths. There were 19 along one short path in Battery Park, each with its own carnival-type barker, and since many sold substandard food, there were recurring reports of sickness among children who ate the hot dogs they sold. Bryant Park, 6 priceless acres of green amid the concrete masses of Midtown, had been allowed to become a haven for drunks and idlers. In 1932, the city obligingly trucked away 2 of the park's principal ornaments, 8-foot-high statues of Washington Irving and James Marion Sims, founder of the first women's hospital in New York, and allowed a George Washington Bicentennial Celebration Commission, debonair Grover Whalen, one of Walker's police commissioners, was chairman, to erect a flimsy reproduction of Federal Hall, the building in which Washington was inaugurated, in the park, and then fence it off and place turnstiles at its corners so that the public would be forced to pay admission to see the hall. When the public declined in great numbers to do so, the commission went out of existence without funds to demolish its creation. After picking up the demolition tab, the city discovered that it had managed to lose the Irving and Sims statues. Possibly because the omission of 5 tons of granite and metal would not be easily concealed in a reconstructed park, Bryant Park was not reconstructed, and in January 1934, it was a weed-filled vacant lot. The Bicentennial Commission was one of the more hilarious episodes in the city's history. Its board of directors contained a number of well-meaning DAR types who had lent their names to what they thought was an attempt to honor the father of the country. But the presence of Whalen, an intimate of some of Tammany's most greedy insiders, was the tip-off to the fact that the celebration was intended as a public scalping party, a suspicion confirmed when food-selling concessions at the celebration were handed out to Tammany favorites. First, the commission announced that it would finance the construction of Federal Hall by allowing citizens to sign a patriotic roll call for a fee of $1 per signature, designed to raise $150,000. Despite parades beginning or ending at Washington Arch and led by Jimmy Walker himself that were designed to whip up public enthusiasm, the roll call was answered by only 18,629 patriots. Sears Roebuck and Company then announced that it would lend the commission the money against turnstile receipts, but the finished structure into which that firm's money was sunk turned out to be a plaster and paper mache structure that swayed alarmingly and looked barely strong enough to withstand a good wind. On some days, total attendance in the park was so low that only 20 persons paid the 25 cents to see it. Whalen then conceived the idea of combining the exhibit with patriotic movies, which turned out to be Mickey Mouse cartoons. When interest remained low, Italian opera was tried. The commission couldn't even raise enough money to demolish Federal Hall and restore Bryant Park to its original condition, as it had promised to do in its contract with the city. It announced that a large part of the population feels that this patriotic shrine should be retained, and went out of existence, leaving $76,254 in largely unexplained expenses and Sears Roebuck holding the bag for its contribution. The hall stood, crumbling around the edges, in the huge vacant lot that Bryant Park had become, until the city, embarrassed by the screams of rage from the Park Association, tore down the structure at its own, or rather at its taxpayers' expense. The bicentennial celebration did, of course, provide Whalen with valuable experience in running a public exposition. He put it to use in running the 1939 New York World's Fair, which lost $200 million. Central Park, most famous and beautiful of the city's open spaces, the most noble, the most praiseworthy, the most philanthropic of all our public works, according to an 1876 New York Herald editorial, had been the creation of Calvert Vaux and the genius of urban landscape, Frederick Law Olmsted, who, in 1857, with Olmsted still an unknown young Park Department employee, had won a nationwide contest with their design for the park. Olmsted had driven thousands of men to plant 500,000 trees and shrubs on its 840 rocky, barren, and arid acres, and to create bowers, mazes, lawns, and vistas, revolutionary sunken transverse roads that were criticized because people said there would never be sufficient traffic across the park to justify them, bridle paths that were criticized because few New Yorkers owned saddle horses, delicate and colorful gardens that were criticized because people said there would always be enough room in New York for private gardens. Then, his vision completed as he wanted it, Olmsted had fought Tammany for a decade to preserve it, his health and spirit breaking in the fight. Finally ousted as park commissioner after a series of worsening nervous breakdowns, he had had to watch hordes of Tammany laborers tear the ivy from the arsenal walls, clean up his beloved wildernesses, sweep moss and ferns out of all the rocky crevices with house brooms, and hack down thousands of trees and shrubs along Fifth Avenue so that park strollers could better view the mansions being built there. And in 1932, Central Park showed the ravages of the 60 years of neglect that had followed Olmsted's ouster. The park's lawns, unseeded, were expanses of bare earth, decorated with scraggly patches of grass and weeds that became dust holes in dry weather and mud holes in wet. Its walks were broken and potholed. Its bridle paths were covered with dung. The once beautiful mall looked like the scene of a wild party the morning after. Benches lay on their backs, their legs jabbing at the sky. Trash baskets had been overturned and never righted. Their contents lay where they had spilled out. The concrete had been stripped off drinking fountains so completely that only their rusting iron pipes remained, and 9 out of every trees on the mall were dead or dying. The red brick of the arsenal at 5th Avenue and 64th Street had been stuccoed over and painted, and when the stucco had flaked away, the bare spots had been repainted in what was supposed to be the same color but wasn't. The building's turrets, which had made it so quaintly medieval, had been covered with striped wooden cupolas, which were supposed to make it gay, but the wood had broken and caved in and had never been repaired. The ground floor was used as a park department garage. The 3 upper floors were used mostly as a warehouse to store department records. Around the arsenal squatted the 22 ancient wooden animal houses of the Central Park Menagerie, crumbling away beneath their yellow paint. So rotted were their walls that Park Department officials feared that a single charge from a large animal, perhaps maddened by fire, might tear the cage bars right out of them. Instead of rebuilding the animal houses, the department had stationed keepers in front of a lion and tiger cages with rifles and had instructed them to shoot the big carnivores if fire broke out. The menagerie was filled with surprises. Because it gratefully accepted any gift that would fill a cage, and people therefore donated their unwanted family pets, it was housing in 1932, alongside the hyacinth cockatoos and the vulturine guinea fowl, several dozen canaries, and in a cage between the mountain lions and the leopards, an Airedale. Because the menagerie did not adequately care for its animals or dispose of them when they grew old, its exhibits included such old pensioners as a senile tiger, a puma with rickets, and a semi-paralyzed baboon. Its most fearsome exhibits were rats, which roamed it in herds that had become so bold that they were stealing food from the lions' feeding pans. The most vivid memory carried away by many visitors was of the sickening stench that rose from the dung-heaped Barbary sheep pen. Almost directly across the park, off Central Park West, was Jacob Ray Mould's sheepfold, considered by some critics the finest existing example of the full-blown architecture of the mid-19th century, and from a distance the sheep who grazed opposite it on the green or sheep meadow, under the care of a resident shepherd who twice a day held up traffic on the park's west drive to herd his flock across, made a picture as pretty as Olmsted had envisioned. But a closer look disclosed that, because for generations the sheep had been allowed to inbreed, every one of them was malformed. Unlovely as the scenery in the parks might be, there was little to do in the parks except contemplate it. Provision for active sports was so inadequate that although Tammany reserved permits for the city's 162 baseball diamonds for teams which had the blessing of its aldermen, Negro teams from politically powerless Harlem seldom got one, there were still 942 teams with permits waiting to use the diamonds on a typical Sunday. Waiting time at tennis courts was measured in hours, and the city's one modern golf course was so crowded on weekends that, the Herald Tribune reported, a player standing on line at dawn is lucky if he gets through his rounds by sunset. New York was a city of islands, a city surrounded by, permeated by, water. But with Orchard Beach and Wolf's Pond Park handed over to Tammany insiders, the only acquaintance that most of the city's lower-income families, who did not own cars and thus were virtually barred from Jones Beach, made with the ocean surf was at Coney Island, where a million people, treading gingerly among broken glass and filth that seemed never to be cleaned up, jammed the beach so full on a Sunday that one could hardly see the sand. The beach at Jacob Riis State Park in the Rockaways was used only sparsely, but there was a reason. There was no way for a family without a car to reach it, and families with cars could reach it only after a torturous trip. Swimming in one's own neighborhood, moreover, was all but unheard of. In the entire city, there were in 1932 two tiny outdoor swimming pools. Children who wanted to wade and splash in an outdoor shower could wade in the gutters after they unscrewed fire hydrant covers. No one had ever heard of wading pools in playgrounds. The men who worked in the parks complimented the scenery. Even in an era in which every city department was staffed through patronage, the five borough park departments were something special. Recalls one observer, "You couldn't tell the difference between a park employee and the bums hanging out in the parks." The weight of the roomy-eyed drunks who served as lifeguards at Jacob Riis State Park, Rockaway Beach, and Coney Island was as excessive for their job as were their ages. "The first time I saw those guys lined up in their swimming costumes, I could hardly believe it," recalls Samuel M. White, who was later put in charge of them. "Some of them ran 225 or 250 pounds, and there were guys there 60 years old." Even on summer Sundays, they used the life-saving dories for fishing. Not all the lifeguards would go out in the dories, of course. Some of them were afraid to. They didn't know how to swim. Parents who took their children to city beaches on Sundays learned not to allow them near the shacks on the beach labeled first aid station. The shacks were invariably filled with prostitutes sleeping off the effects of their Saturday night parties with the lifeguards. "Those whores were as unbelievable as the guys," White recalls. "They were some of the ugliest women I have ever seen." The aged biddies in charge of park comfort stations were widows of Tammany ward healers, and they understood that no work was required of them. According to one reporter, some had curtained off all but, say, two of the eight toilet compartments, had imported chairs, tables, and hangings into the cozy space, and frequently had in their friends to afternoon tea. The lady in charge of the comfort station, perched on a rocky bluff overlooking the Metropolitan Museum of Art, spent her time there removing much of the plumbing and then building herself a cozy little sitting room in which she had installed a grand piano. The chords of a Chopin nocturne startled more than one woman who entered the comfort station in good faith. The Depression added its own touches to the parks. The shack towns, named bitterly Hoovervilles, in which homeless men sought refuge. One of the largest was a collection of more than 200 hovels of old boards, flattened gasoline tins, and pieces of sheet iron and cardboard in the dried-out bed of the abandoned Central Park receiving reservoir behind the Metropolitan Museum of Art. At night, its inhabitants ate birds they caught in the park's bird sanctuary. It wasn't what the Depression did to existing parks that most worried New York's reformers, however. They were more concerned about its effect on the city's plans to acquire new ones. Nothing was more disturbing to reformers than the city's lack of parkland. In 1932, only 14,827 acres, or 7.28% of its area, had been set aside for the recreation of its citizens, a percentage smaller than that set aside for recreation in any of the other 10 largest cities in the world or in America. And almost half the 14,827 acres were not really parks, but only land intended for parks. 3,256 of those acres, for example, were contained in the two marine parks in Brooklyn and Staten Island, and these two parks were nothing but utterly undeveloped marshlands underwater part of each day. There was least parkland, moreover, in those areas that needed parks the most. For generations, reformers had been attempting to nerve city officials to buy up tenements, tear them down, and thereby shatter with shafts of sunlight the solid shadows of slum streets. But the difficulties of relocating tenement families, the veto power over city policies exercised by powerful Tammany district leaders who didn't want Democratic voters removed from their districts, and the lack of will to civic improvement had kept the Hyland and Walker administrations from taking the leap. And the economy-minded Lowe and Mitchell administrations, led to the brink several times, had always shied away at the last moment because of the sheer enormity of the cost involved. As a result, after nearly a century of agitation for the creation of breathing spaces in slums, Moses' grandfather, Bernard Cohen, had been one of the agitators during the 1870s, there were on the Lower East Side, in an area a mile wide into which were crammed more than 500,000 people, exactly two small parks, neither of which contained a single piece of play equipment. With the exception of a block-square, dirt-and-weed-covered vacant lot owned by the city at Corlear's Hook, just to the east of this area, there was not another clearing in the wilderness of tenements stretching away from the massive granite piers of the Brooklyn Bridge all the way to Tompkins Square, 31 blocks to the north. And if one stood atop the Upper West Side's high ridge in Morningside, St. Nicholas, or Colonial Park, and looked down to where the ridge fell suddenly into an alluvial plain once known as Harlem Flats, which in 1932 contained the city's Spanish, Negro, and Italian slum areas, he would see nothing between the end of Central Park on 110th Street down to his right and the beginning of Coonan's Bluff at 155th Street down to his left, but a vast expanse of the asphalt gray of streets, the tar-paper gray of tenement roofs, and the dingy brick red of tenement walls, stretching endlessly eastward until it was at last mercifully cut short by the East River, an expanse in which, except for a poignant hint on the rocky slopes of Mount Morris Park at 124th Street, there did not exist a single patch of green. Wrote one reformer, "In the winter months, when the sun is most needed, it is no uncommon sight to see herds of children blocking the streets in sections where a little sun has been allowed to penetrate because there happen to be a few low buildings on one side of the street." If slum children could not have parks, reformers had pleaded, at least let them have the tiny, pathetic, chicken-wire-fenced, cinder-paved substitute known as playgrounds. But in 1932, after generations of such pleading, there were only four playgrounds on the Lower East Side and two playgrounds in Harlem. In all Brooklyn, there were only 36 playgrounds. In all New York, a city which in 1932 contained approximately 1,700,000 children under 12 years of age, there were only 119, or one for every 14,000 children. Children's gardens in playgrounds were the only places in which most slum children could engage in that most precious of childhood activities, digging. So few were the playgrounds and their gardens that they could accommodate no more than a handful of those who wanted to use them. Playground supervisors made children stand on line with their pails and shovels until a spot in the gardens was open, and the lines were so long that most of the little girls and boys could see at a glance that they were unlikely to get a turn. Most of them stood on the line anyway. Childhood, after all, is the time of hope, and there was, after all, little else for them to do. Reformers had at least hoped that the difficulty of obtaining parkland in areas of the city that had already been built up had taught city officials the necessity of reserving land for parks in other areas before they were built up. But all during the 1920s, as they watched with horror, the city allowed developers to devour its open spaces without making more than a few gestures in this direction. Before the reformers' eyes, the red bricks that had walled out the sun in the Lower East Side and Harlem were cemented into place on the hills and meadows of the Bronx and Queens. "It looks as though all sunshine will soon be crowded out and dark shadows take its place," one reformer wrote in despair. While campaigning for mayor in 1925, Jimmy Walker had promised to spend money lavishly to renovate Central Park, and no one could accuse him of a complete breach of faith. For not 400 yards beyond the 65th Street Transverse Road, which formed the northern border of the menagerie, visible from the Barbary sheep pen when winter stripped the leaves from the park's trees, was dramatic evidence that, in at least one location in Central Park, Walker had more than kept his word. Not 400 yards beyond the Transverse Road stood the Central Park Casino, a legend in its time. The casino was the brainchild of restaurateur Sidney Solomon, frontman for a cabal of socialites and Tammany officials who felt the need, as Walker euphemistically put it, of a sanctuary in which they might entertain visitors without being molested. He asked the mayor to let him establish one in the casino, a low, rambling, brick-and-stone building that had been built in the park in 1864 as a ladies' refreshment salon and had since been turned into a quiet little nightclub. Walker owed Solomon a great debt. The restaurateur had introduced him to his favorite tailor. Throwing out the nightclub's previous owner, the mayor turned it over to Solomon for a rental of $8,500 a year, a sum which turned out to be equal to one night's receipts. "The casino will be our place, Monk," Walker reportedly said to his mistress, Betty Monk Compton. Mrs. Walker's place was apparently Florida, the state to which she had been packed off for an extended vacation. Although Solomon retained the celebrated Viennese interior decorator Josef Urban, who announced that he would strive for a feeling of wind among young leaves, none of Urban's sketches was executed until Jimmy and Monk approved. The mayor, whose disregard of city affairs was legendary, dedicated himself to making the casino perfect in every detail. When it had been renovated, at a cost to Solomon and his backers of $365,000, and the restaurateur was about to announce its opening, Walker noticed that one of the bandstands blocked the head waiter's view of the main entrance and thus deprived him of time to screen his guests and decide how important they were and where to seat them. He insisted that a new entrance be constructed, and it was, at a cost of $22,000. When it opened, the casino was hailed by one well-qualified observer as the swankiest restaurant New York has yet seen. The dining pavilion was silver and maroon, the ballroom, except for Urban's flowing golden murals, all black glass. The day room fumed knotty pine. Emil Coleman's popular society orchestra played in the pavilion, Leo Reisman's in the black and gold room. Spelling the orchestras were two pianists, the famous Nat Brandywine and a handsome youngster, unknown, on whom Solomon had decided to take a chance, Eddie Duchin. But the casino was more than a restaurant or a nightclub. The casino was Jimmy Walker's Versailles. Friends joked that the mayor spent more time there than he did at City Hall. When his limousine pulled into view, the doorman would scurry inside and signal the orchestra so that when Beau James and Betty entered, it would be to strains of Will You Love Me in December. Holding hands with Betty, sipping champagne while she sipped beer, the mayor would receive the parade of visitors to his table with careless ease, and sometimes, when Betty asked him to dance, he would even arise, pinch-waisted and slim in the tuxedo with the shiny lapels that people were beginning to copy, and glide with her around the floor, and the mayor's friends would know that he was feeling very good indeed, for although he was so graceful a dancer that he had once wanted to be a professional, for years before he met Betty, he had refused to dance a step, for reasons he never told anyone. The regulars at Walker's Court played their parts well. They brought their own champagne, their chauffeurs cooling it outside in the Rolls Royces lined up along the dark paths until the doorman signaled that another bottle was wanted at table. Their wives and girlfriends crowded around the bandstands so Reisman and Coleman and Brandywine could autograph their slippers. Their spending was in character. One insurance man always announced his arrival by handing a $1,000 bill to the band leader. At closing time, the bills fluttering down onto the hat check girl's little silver trays seemed to one observer to be mostly hundreds. Reisman and Coleman were offered fabulous fees to play on after closing at private homes, and when the society crowd discovered Duchin, there was no limit to their generosity. A member of the Grace Steamship family once paid him $20,000 to play at a party. The Depression? What depression? Until LaGuardia came in, we never had a losing day, panic or no panic, Solomon was to say. And in a duplex upstairs retreat, closed to the public, its very existence concealed by the building's lowering mansard roof, Tammany politicians were entertained by Broadway chorus lines, rushed to the casino en masse by motorcycle escort. And all the while, in a small adjoining office, its walls covered with green moiré and its ceiling with gold leaf, its heavy door carefully soundproofed, Walker held court for favor-seekers and politicians. And it was there, insiders said, that much of the city's business was transacted. Moses' attention had been drawn back to New York even before the Depression. Realizing in 1926 that city officials were not following through on promises to plan a new Queens Road network to feed the Long Island parkways he was building, he had, during a solid year of conferences, all but begged the officials to widen Queens, Northern, and Conduit Boulevards and other major east-west thoroughfares in Brooklyn and Queens to link Queens Boulevard with the Northern State Parkway to make good on the promise given to him in 1924 and widen the two-mile stretch of Central Avenue, the narrow winding farm road that was the only route to the Southern State Parkway. Disturbed that Bronx and Westchester residents could reach his Long Island parks only by driving down into Manhattan and across the Queensboro Bridge, he had persuaded Al Smith to urge a start on construction of the long-talked-about Triborough Bridge. But in 1932, 6 years later, not even a start had been made on building these thoroughfares, with the exception of Queens Boulevard, on which work was proceeding so desultorily that its completion was nowhere in sight, and the farms that in 1926 could have been acquired cheaply for the right-of-way had become subdivisions the city could no longer afford to buy. Central Avenue was still unwidened. 6 years after the opening of the most modern highway in the United States, the only approach to it was still a farm road. And as for the Triborough Bridge, the ring of the pile drivers hammering in its foundations after Mayor Walker had broken ground on October 25, 1929, had a distinctly hollow undertone. For while city officials were proclaiming that New York's traffic problems would be largely solved on the day that cars could speed up its mighty ramps, Moses was asking the project's chief engineer, a Tammany hack who had entered city service in 1886 as an axeman, where the cars were going to go when they came down, and was learning that no one had thought to plan even a single approach road at any one of the bridge's three termini. And upset as Moses was at that, he soon realized that it was likely to be of no consequence. October 25, 1929, was a Friday, the Friday after Black Thursday, the day of the stock market crash. The proximity of the 2 days proved significant. The city's $5,400,000 initial allocation, largely wasted on extravagant condemnation awards, council fees, and other items of Tammany graft, ran out after the Ward's Island piers had been built, and the city was prevented by the Depression from raising any additional funds for the project. In 1932, it had been at a complete standstill for 2 years. Moses' plans for New York were not confined to Queens. The city's prestigious park association, inspired by his Long Island work to attempt again to save the city's fast disappearing open spaces, had formed the Metropolitan Park Conference and made him its chairman. Assigning selected state parks council staffers to city problems, without the knowledge of the legislature, of course, he furnished the reformers with the ingredients their efforts had been lacking. The expertise of engineers, landscape architects, draftsmen, and surveyors experienced in park work. There were plenty of ideas for park acquisition floating around the city. Some had been floating around for decades. Now, Moses firmed up these ideas, made them concrete, codified them in terms that enabled the reformers to present specific demands to the Walker administration. And Moses gave the reformers something as valuable as his organization. He gave them his vision. No sooner had he become chairman of the Metropolitan Park Conference than he began driving endlessly around New York. The big black Packard that had once been pulled up in the yards of Long Island farmhouses was parked now at the edge of the lonely marshes on the shore of Jamaica Bay, in the empty, rocky fields on a deserted Bronx peninsula known as Ferry Point, and at the spot on Riverside Drive, to which, 20 years before, he had taken taxicabs while he was conceiving his great highway along the Hudson. And while his chauffeur waited in the car, he was walking around, with the same long, restless strides with which he had covered Long Island, lost in concentration, occasionally making sketches on a yellow legal notepad. On February 25, 1930, before 500 civic leaders gathered in the grand ballroom of the Hotel Commodore for the Park Association's annual dinner, Robert Moses, dressed in tuxedo and black tie, tied by Mary, rose to his feet and tugged a cord which dramatically pulled the drapery from a huge map of New York City hanging behind the dais. Running across the map were heavy red lines. One, which started in Brooklyn at the Brooklyn Bridge, ran along the borough's western and southern shores, skirting Jamaica Bay, and then in Queens, headed north along the city's eastern boundary. The shorefront portion, Moses said, was a marginal boulevard. He had not yet named it the Belt Parkway, which would provide a quick circumferential passage around Brooklyn. The portion that ran north along the city boundary was a Cross Island Parkway. A third of the way up its length, it crossed and linked up with the Southern State Parkway. Two-thirds of the way up, it crossed and linked up with the Northern State and with the proposed Grand Central Parkway. And at its end was a bridge, a Ferry Point Whitestone Bridge, he called it, not yet having named it the Bronx Whitestone, that would enable motorists to speed across Long Island Sound. And then, the audience's eyes followed the pointer in Moses' hand. At the northern end of the Ferry Point Whitestone Bridge was another line, heading northeast to link up with the Hutchinson River Parkway that had already been built in Westchester County, almost as far north as the Connecticut border. This, Moses said, was a Hutchinson River Parkway extension. The audience, most of whose members had been concerned for years about the city's traffic problems, grasped at once the significance of what Moses was showing them. If the marginal boulevard, the Ferry Point Whitestone Bridge, and the Hutchinson River Parkway extension were built, they saw, motorists would be able to leave Manhattan Island on the Brooklyn Bridge and then proceed over broad, modern roads, unhindered by a single traffic light, all the way around Brooklyn to the Long Island parkways and parks. In addition, Manhattan and Brooklyn motorists would be presented with a through route to the Bronx, Westchester, and New England, and so would motorists from Nassau and Suffolk counties. And, looking at it in reverse, the Bronx, Westchester, and New England would suddenly be brought within easy access of the Long Island parks. Moses' pointer reversed itself, tracing the marginal boulevard backward around Brooklyn. When it got to the Narrows, at a point opposite Staten Island, it stopped. Planners had long dreamed of a crossing between Brooklyn and Staten Island, Moses said. The Narrows tube had been only one of several abortive attempts to make that dream reality. Now it was time to finish the tube. As soon as it was built, it could be linked with a parkway system on scenic Staten Island. More red lines rimmed the shoreline there, and via a parkway straight across the island with the Goethals and Outer Bridge Crossing bridges on its western shore. And on the other side of those crossings, the audience realized with a start, was New Jersey. Moses' plan would give the city at last the long-discussed northeastern bypass, the route, so long vaguely dreamed of by planners, that would enable traffic to and from New England and points south of the city to avoid crowded Manhattan Island and stop jamming its streets, that would free Manhattan Island forever from tens of thousands of cars and trucks that flooded into it every day, although it was not their destination. And there wouldn't be only one bypass route. The pointer flicked back across the Narrows, and then eastward and northward along the marginal boulevard, until it reached its intersection with the Grand Central Parkway. The western terminus of the Grand Central was no longer Queens Boulevard, the audience saw. Now, the parkway extended westward all the way to the point where the Triborough Bridge was supposed to touch down in Queens. And from the proposed Bronx terminus of the Triborough, red lines radiated out northwestward along the Harlem River to the Sawmill River Parkway he was building in Westchester County, and northeastward along Bruckner Boulevard to the Hutchinson River Parkway extension. These, Moses said, would be other parkways. And as he said it, the reform leader sitting on the dais suddenly realized that the lines behind Moses formed a whole series of rough but concentric rings that would provide a whole series of possible bypass routes around the city, and at the same time would make the parks and parkways Moses had built on Long Island easily accessible to any family in the city with a car. Manhattan motorists would be able to drive all the way to Jones Beach without ever being slowed by a traffic light or intersecting traffic. Turn those red lines on Moses' map into concrete, they realized, and motorists in great sections of the city would be largely freed from the trap of local streets in which they had been so long confined. There were other lines on the map, too. One ran along the western shore of Manhattan Island, all the way up to the Harlem River, over the river and up through the Bronx. If the West Side Elevated Highway was extended up through Riverside Park, Moses said, and if it was carried across the Harlem by the Henry Hudson Bridge, and if it then ran north to the city line, its northern terminus would be within 3 miles of the southern terminus of the Sawmill River Parkway the state was constructing. If the city built the parkway, the Henry Hudson Parkway, he called it, he would see that the state extended the Sawmill River Parkway south to meet it, and there would be a continuous through route from the bottom of Manhattan Island to Westchester County. A Henry Hudson Parkway would provide further advantages, Moses explained. It would give the city a fast, modern route to the George Washington Bridge. On the other side of that bridge was Palisades Interstate Park. It would no longer be difficult to reach it. All New Jersey, in fact, would be opened to motorists from the west side of Manhattan. And if the Henry Hudson Parkway was built properly, and a great park created alongside it on what was now the mudflats of Riverside Park, the city's residents would not even have to leave the city to find beauty. They would be able to drive along the water, the river stretching to one side of them, the green of the park to the other, above the park, the spires of Manhattan. It would be a public improvement unequaled in the world. Before he finished talking about parkways, Moses said, he had a final point. The plan he proposed was admittedly somewhat ambitious, but it was realistic and it was realizable. The dream of opening to the residents of New York City the beauty of the lands around it was in reach. After all, he said, much of it was already reality. The Southern State, Northern State, and Hutchinson River parkways were already built. The Sawmill River Parkway begun. Much of the rest of it was begun. The State Council of Parks was committed to building the Sawmill River Parkway and Hutchinson River Parkway extensions. At least a start had been made on the Triborough Bridge and the West Side Highway. All that needed to be done was to knit these elements together. Now, he said, he wanted to discuss parks. His listeners, who had noticed that the park along the Henry Hudson Parkway was colored green on the map, saw that much of the land bordering the other parkways Moses was proposing was also green. All along the parkways, he said, there should be small parks. The parkway's right-of-way itself should be ribbon parks, similar to those along the parkways on Long Island. Obtaining the necessary land would be easy along much of the marginal boulevard and Cross Island Parkway, and along all the parkways in Staten Island, because the areas these parkways ran through were still largely undeveloped and land there was cheap. It would be expensive to buy land along some of the other parkways, but it was never going to become cheaper. It would only become more expensive. It should be bought now. The larger green areas on the map, he said, represented larger parks. Specifically, he said, they represented a substantial portion of the last areas of natural beauty remaining in the city. The corridor parks he was proposing in eastern Queens, for example, running roughly along the route of the proposed Grand Central Parkway, represented the last undeveloped portions of the heavily forested hills of the glacial moraine. The parks he was proposing along the north shore of Jamaica Bay represented the last chance to preserve from commercial exploitation the bay's wild marshes and abundant animal and bird life. The park he was proposing on the meadows at Flushing Bay represented the last chance to preserve a portion of that bay from development. These parks, he said, should be purchased at once. His engineers had compiled estimates of their cost, and it was $30 million. A bond issue for that amount should be authorized at once by the Board of Estimate. Admittedly, it would take a hard fight to persuade the board to do what had to be done. He invited the people listening to him to join in that fight. The reformers stood up and cheered when Moses had finished, but the reaction of city officials was somewhat less satisfying. For all the cooperation he received from them, he might still have been the starry-eyed idealist of 1914, arguing in the language of a Yale bull session for the construction of mothers' shelters in Central Park. The scale of his plans was too big for them. Not one city official, he would recall, seemed capable of comprehending a highway network on the scale he had proposed, a fact which would not have been surprising even if the officials had been men of vision, since no highway network on that scale had ever been proposed for any city in America, or for that matter, any city in the world. The scale of the money involved was too big for them. The total cost would obviously be in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and they felt there was no sense in the city even considering such an amount. What the city officials could comprehend about Moses' plan, they didn't like. The relocations involved for his highways would be on a scale almost unknown in the city. The The Whitlock Avenue approach to the Triborough Bridge in the Bronx would alone require the condemnation of buildings containing more than 4,000 apartments, voters' apartments. Moses' general plans for his parkway system were turned over for analysis to city engineers, who, sensing the attitude of their superiors, did not rush to begin working on them. Try as he would, Moses could not get the city to move on them. And once the Depression began to tighten its hold on New York, there was no longer much sense in trying to get the city to move. In 1932, the city had not even begun seriously considering any of the parkways he had proposed at the Hotel Commodore dinner 2 years before. Walker's administration did agree in 1930 to issue $30 million in bonds to buy new parkland. In 1930, the city acquired 2,530 acres that would be known as Great Kills and Willowbrook Parks on Staten Island, Highland, Alley Pond, and Casena Parks in Queens, and Owl's Head Park in Brooklyn. But, by the end of that year, it was becoming apparent that the city's people had needs even more pressing than the need for parks, even if there had still been any market for the bonds that had to be sold to buy them. In 1932, with only $4 million of the $30 million spent and exactly one tenement area park acquired, even most reformers were agreeing that acquisition of parkland was a luxury that New York would have to postpone to some other, happier decade. When Roosevelt, under Moses' prodding, agreed to fight the Depression with a state public works program of unprecedented size, Moses saw the agreement as a chance to make the city move. The state had never spent any money on roads in New York City, but Moses persuaded Roosevelt to authorize the state's Temporary Emergency Relief Administration to pay the construction costs of the Grand Central Parkway and the Central Avenue link-up with the Southern State Parkway, and of another interborough parkway, long proposed but never built, that would provide access into and out of central Brooklyn. The city would have to pay only for the right-of-way. The legislature, having learned the inadvisability of giving Moses an opportunity to drive the opening wedge for a project that would later turn out to cost many times what he had estimated, gave Moses only $5 million, payable at the rate of a paltry $1 million per year. All other expenses, the bill provided, must be paid by the city. But in the city, Moses had no political leverage. The Board of Estimate kept delaying approval of the route, the allocations for right-of-way kept getting involved in endless snarls, and at the end of 1933, Moses could look back and see that it had taken him as long to build a total of 2 miles of the parkway projects in Queens as it had taken him to build 22 miles of the Southern State Parkway. Roosevelt's successor as governor, Herbert H. Lehman, deeply respected Moses. Says one man who served as an advisor to both, Roosevelt saw Jones Beach in terms both of people swimming and in terms of the political gains that could come from those people swimming. Herbert Lehman thought only of helping people to go swimming and be happy, and he felt that no one could do that job better than Robert Moses. Within a month after Lehman took office in January 1933, he handed to Moses even more power than Roosevelt had given him. In 1932, Congress, at President Hoover's request, had created the Reconstruction Finance Corporation to help self-supporting public works projects. Lehman set up a state emergency public works commission to screen such projects and determine which should be submitted to Washington, and named Moses its chairman. This post gave Moses the power to get work underway on his huge park and parkway plan for the Niagara Frontier. A Niagara Frontier Bridge Authority was established, received $2,800,000 in federal funds, and constructed bridges that linked both the north and south ends of Grand Island, near Buffalo, to the mainland. A Thousand Islands Bridge Authority built the International Bridge to Canada. Under his direction, a New York State Bridge Authority was established to purchase, through agreements he negotiated, the Bear Mountain Bridge from the Harrimans and its other private owners. A Saratoga Springs Authority began refurbishing and expanding the spa. Negotiating in Washington with the RFC, Moses obtained funds for the Port of New York Authority to construct the Lincoln Tunnel, and for the city to construct Hillside, Knickerbocker, and other housing developments. And he persuaded Mayor O'Brien to ask the legislature to establish a Triborough Bridge Authority that could issue its own bonds, secured by toll revenues, and that would therefore be eligible for aid from the newly formed Federal Public Works Administration. And the PWA granted a $44,200,000 combination loan and grant to the authority on condition that the city make certain additional token contributions. But hardly had the Tammany-controlled authority gotten its hands on the first installment of the grant than it blew it on inflated condemnation awards and council fees. In addition, the city proved unable to make even the first installment of its token payment. The PWA thereupon cut off funds and announced that no more would be forthcoming until the city paid up and the authority cleaned up, and in 1933 there were no immediate prospects of either development. In vain, Moses pointed out to the Board of Estimate that the money the TERA and PWA were prepared to spend in New York would create vast improvements in the city at virtually no cost to its taxpayers. In vain, he pointed out that the money would put thousands of hungry men to work for salaries that would feed their families. Such considerations were not of interest to the Tammany-dominated board. And those that were of interest, Moses, outside the city's power structure as he was, could not offer them. All through 1933, the city's financial situation worsened. In May, City Comptroller Charles W. Berry informed Mayor O'Brien that the city would be unable to pay $100 million in short-term revenue notes coming due in June. The bankers agreed to extend the notes only after the city agreed to an almost doubled interest rate and budget cuts so stringent that they made it all but impossible for the city to keep its physical plant in repair. And, despite the extension, in September, Berry told O'Brien that the city would be unable to meet its October 24th payroll. After 9 days of frantic meetings, in which a worried Governor Lehman participated, the bankers agreed on September 27th to further extensions, after the city agreed to accept even more stringent repayment provisions and to balance its 1934 budget. The city's worries were still not over. It required legislative authorization to meet the bankers' demands, but the legislature's Republican majority saw the city's plight as a lever they could use to pry various concessions from Lehman, and a long, tense bargaining session ensued. Not until October 18th, just 6 days before the city would, by all common business definitions, enter a state of bankruptcy, was the authorization given. And a look ahead was hardly reassuring. The amount of short-term revenue notes coming due in the next 2 years was $500 million. Nevertheless, in the summer of 1933, Moses was convinced that events were moving for rather than against him. For during that summer, over a period of several weeks, he was convinced that he was going to get a chance personally to move the city as its next mayor. Chapter 19. To Power in the City. In New York City, 1933 was the year of the goo-goo. Dormant since debonair John Peroy Mitchell had once stepped it into the ground nearly 2 decades before, the city's good government movement, goo-goos was the politician's epithet for the men and women in it, had been hauled back on its feet by stern-visaged, cane-carrying Samuel Seabury. In the early stages of the Seabury investigation, the city had only snickered at the fantastic alibis offered by the participants in the Tin Box Parade. Pretty young women had thrown roses at Jimmy Walker's feet as he left the hearing room after testifying. But as Seabury's quiet, courteous, but relentless proddings reached higher and higher, and the revelations it uncovered became more and more sordid, not even a $10 million welfare fund for the unemployed went unlooted, and, as the deepening depression made the public less tolerant of the making of illegal fortunes with its money, the laughter faded. In the last weeks of the hearing, when Seabury left the courthouse in Foley Square for lunch, Thousands of men and women hung out the windows of surrounding office buildings to cheer him. The judge courteously raised his hat, but did not smile. Mayor John Patrick O'Brien was proving that his gaffe about the police commissioner was in character. A master of the malapropism, he told a Harlem audience, "My heart is as black as yours," and he